You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
Welcome to the Cigar Nerd Podcast. I'm Smoking Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
What are we smoking today, Brad, so the viewers can smoke along at home?
Today we are smoking the Camacho Triple Maduro.
Another one who's black like my soul.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, man. I think we got a little bit of jungle fever or something on the podcast, because our cigars just keep getting darker and darker.
Yeah, this is a full-strength Habano Maduro from Honduras. I think it's the first Honduran cigar we've had.
Yeah, this is actually the world's first all Maduro cigar.
Yeah, a lot of time with the Maduros, you get a Maduro wrapper, but then the interior will be something else, or vice versa. But this is like, you know, black on black.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, being the triple Maduro, it's definitely a full-bodied blend. And, you know, I've just started this, so, you know, we'll see how it goes once I get down to the second third and then to the last third, because I'm anticipating this thing to be rocket fuel.
Yeah, if you're not a full-bodied smoker, you're going to have a buzz before this is over with. All right, well, let's get into the topic of the show. If you can guess from our we're talking about the rules of the drinking game. That's going to be one of the rules, is if you can guess what the show topic is by our intro music, yeah, take a drink.
No way. No, you just finish whatever you're drinking. Yeah. So if you've got a glass or a bottle, man up or woman up. We're non-discriminating here.
Today we're talking about the films and TV shows of Mr. Josh Whedon. And to help out with that, we have another guest in the Nerd Cave, Mr. Wayne Hutchison.
Hey.
Introduce yourself, sir, and tell him a little bit about your Josh Whedon, what makes you our sure. local expert.
My name is Wayne Hutchison, and I have been a Joss Whedon fan since 1992, when I first saw the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie in the theaters the day it opened, because nothing else was playing that day. And ever since then, it's been a horrible, horrible addiction. I also was the track director at Dragon Con for the Whedon Universe track for 7 years. I actually started that track and ran it for 7 years before turning it over in 2013. And ever to a good friend of mine named Mary, who does a fabulous job running it now. And I have spent those 7 years cultivating a lot of Whedon knowledge and Whedon experience, and keeping up with new and old, and just keeping people alive and well with the
I don't think
Joss.
I made it to any Whedon panels this time, so I can't tell you how your replacement's doing, but it's always been fun stuff in the past. She's doing very well.
She had some big shoes to fill, but because I ran the track with my wife, Melissa, and so
I had a partner the other night, and she's hardcore Buffy fan.
Yes, she is.
Well, what does a track director do?
Well, you know, Dragon Con is it is a lot of people say the Comic-Con of the East Coast. It is
it's
a very large track.
Crowded.
It's a little different than a lot of other conventions, though.
Getting crowded.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
right.
You know, yeah, I mean, you know, 50,000 people.
Hey, rooms went on sale today. Oh, yeah, they're all sold out.
Yeah,
so good luck finding somewhere within a 10-mile radius.
We've already failed the great land grab of 2014,
yeah,
so we're going
to
be looking for a room.
I have the distinct fortune of fixing the Marriott servers when they break, so thanks, folks. But anyway, Dragon Con is devised into different tracks, and that's all fan-run. So unlike Comic-Con, which is a trade show, it's actually fan-run. So
that's the thing I like about Dragon Con. Yeah. It's not such a corporate event. It's, you know,
no.
it's for the people, by the people.
It's not corporate at all. I mean, you know, the board of directors and everything, they're all, you know, from everyone on down, they're all giant fans and geeks and nerds and everything that you can think of. So So it's run with that in mind, you know, that first. But a track director takes a particular genre of sci-fi and new media, whatever, and runs that. And that can be a very large or very small portion of the track. But what it does is it focuses interest on a particular area, like Star Wars or Whedon or Marvel or comics or, you know, artists or, you know, music or filking or something like that. And then they find someone to run that who gets a staff of 7 people, and you put on 43 hours of programming. And it may or may not involve celebrities and drinking and you know, debauchery, or hours at a computer looking at the same Word document for hours and hours and hours. So
yeah, I've had a few friends that have worked on tracks and stuff, and anytime I run into them, they look like their head is about to explode. I'm like, it's just like, it looks like a complicated job, sir.
It's year round. I'll be honest with you, it's year round. I mean, don't get me wrong, this is the slow area. This is the slow period for the folks right now.
But post-con hangover.
January is when everything starts over as far as programming goes, and then running up into the Labor Day show, it's an intense, intense race. And
well, let me ask you this: who's your favorite Whedonverse guest that you've had the opportunity to meet?
There's a lot of them. I've actually met a lot of the bigger ones too. I have to say, from experience wise, just the experience I had with the person and everything, it'd have to be J. August Richards, who played Gunn on Angel.
Oh yeah.
Only because he couldn't keep away from us when he Dragon Con was like surreal to this guy. I mean, you're talking about a guy that's done Comic Con, you know, and trade shows, you know, Omega Con, stuff like that, where it's very corporate, it's very structured, and he was not expecting to be shoulder to shoulder with 50,000 of his closest fans.
He's not used to rolling without like a security escort.
I think, as a matter of fact, he said it was the this place is like Twitter but in real life, because I say things and people respond, but they're in front of me responding, and I don't.
That's a good description.
And I feel safe. And I was
that.
Like, yeah, that's great. That's great. But he spent a lot of time with us in the track room after hours. Snapped maybe, not kidding, around 200, 250 pictures with people after a panel, and wouldn't let us lock the room because he just wanted to hang with his fans. So
that's awesome. You
know. That's one of the cool things about Dragon Con is like the people, the celebrities there, it seems like a comfortable environment. I mean, you'll run into people out the parties and stuff when, you know,
right.
You know, they'll show up for panels themselves sometimes. It's
cool. Much more personable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like people like Felicia Day go to the dance parties. You know, Felicia Day's, you know, well known throughout Supernatural and the Whedonverse. And yeah,
I met her a year before last. She was super nice.
These guys get off work. They don't like just go run back to their hotel rooms and hide from everybody. They go out and drink and have fun. I mean, of course, they got their entourage with them, so they don't.
J. August Richards, I liked him on season 1 Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I mean, that was a cool character he was doing.
And it's funny, I met him right before that aired, because that aired the week after Dragon Con, and we kept asking him about it. He was just like, I can't say it, man. Sorry, I can't say it. Are you going to be a recurring character? I can't tell you. And finally, he just told us, look, I'll tell you anything you want to know. I'll show you my underwear size if you want, but I can't tell you what I'm doing on S.H.I.E.L.D.
All right, well, then let's get into the topic at hand. Let's start off with the Buffy. I mean, you already mentioned the movie. That's probably the first Whedon thing I remember watching, which I didn't realize created the TV show, but I didn't realize that he wrote the original movie, because it's so different than what the TV show ended up being.
Yeah, the movie, believe it or not, was a little bit more campy than it was originally intended to be, and that's because some folks, if you watch the opening credits, named Fran and Rebel Kozwai, and I'm sure I pronounced that wrong, but they actually kind of dumbed it down a little bit, because their belief was that it had a female character, a female lead, and, you know, that was going to be campy. That wasn't to be taken seriously. She's not Sarah Connor. She's not Ellen Ripley. She's, you know, Buffy. Her name's Buffy.
He said, too, that, like, his original concept was a lot darker and a lot more what the TV show. And he, you know, his vision was going to be a horror movie with, you know, a female empowerment theme in it. And then,
well, you see that a lot in, you know, Whedon stuff.
Yeah, he has some like good and strong female characters throughout all of this stuff.
He's known for it, and of course he's tired of answering it at this point. He says, because the reason I still write these strong female characters is you're still asking me. And so
there's obviously a fan base.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what's funny is I actually appreciate, I mean, I'm as a you know, middle-aged man, I actually appreciate a strong female character more than I do a strong male character, because it just seems like it's expected
a strong male character.
With a male character, but, you know, when you see a strong female character, it shows, you know, internal struggle and, you know, way to actually manifest that into physical power. And
it's the reverse of the horror movie trope that the cheerleader is always going to be the first first to die.
And that was his concept. You know, the blonde walks into an alley and something scary follows her and the blonde wins. That was his concept. Because I always wanted to see that in movies. And so that's where you got Buffy the Vampire Slayer from.
Yeah, that first movie was you know, even though it wasn't as dark as it probably should have been, it was a good movie. I mean, we had Luke Perry.
Yes. Yeah.
And Paul Rubens as one of the big vampires. And that was like just right after his incident in the movie theater.
Right. And then, of course, you had Rucker Hauer, who apparently was very difficult to work with in that movie and almost ruined it. So.
And Donald Sutherland as the Watcher, too. I mean, there were some big names in that movie.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. Donald Sutherland is still relevant out there. He's still big. I mean, he's in the Hunger Games movies and... He's still a villainous, lovable kind of villainous guy.
I loved him in Beer Fest.
Yeah. You know, I liked him in the original MASH movie just to show my age a little bit.
And, I was just talking about MASH earlier today. Yeah, that's I forgot about him in the original MASH movie. In
Animal House, of course, you know.
Of course.
But yeah, the original, the series, when the series came out, that was Joss's chance to say, reboot, got a chance to do it over. Yeah, the first season's a little hard to get through. Just get through it. Just really get through it.
I've not gone back and watched that first season in a while.
I'm telling you, it's like a good steak, man. Once it gets into the middle, like the third or fourth season, flip it, and then it's perfect after another couple of seasons.
Got the flavor and everything else there.
Good. Gosh, it gets so good. Such a great show.
Oh, yeah, that show came out about the time I think I graduated high school, and it was like right in my wheelhouse. I love horror. I love martial arts, and it was just a good combination of both. And it was something that you really hadn't seen that much on TV at that point. It was, like I said, the cheerleader is the badass.
Yeah, and it was so much deeper than that. I mean, the secondary and tertiary characters, too, really,
the Scooby Gang
pulled it together, man. I mean, they made it so much worth watching. Added a little bit of a soap opera to it, but not, you know, not like a Dawson's Creek or not a 2-0 teen drama kind of soap opera.
That was the best part of it, because even when it got, with her and Angel got a little bit emo and stuff, they were still killing vampires and monsters while they were having their relationship difficulties. So you got the soap opera stuff, but with, you know, some good old-fashioned violence and monsters.
Great. Another apocalypse. Let's do it.
Yeah. This week, again, another. How many apocalypses do we have to stop?
I mean, the world is always trying to end, apparently.
Yeah, the secondary, you know, a lot of shows too, your secondary characters just kind of get glossed over, but I mean, they had some like strong secondary characters.
Yeah, they had episodes dedicated to characters in Buffy, which we really, really kind of drove the point home that this she does not stand alone. Even though the opening kind of says one girl must stand alone, she doesn't. She's got friends.
She got a whole
crew.
That
was her competitive edge over all the other Slayers.
I always liked Giles. I mean, I thought his character was great. He's shown up on a lot of stuff recently. He was like recently the bad guy on the last season of Warehouse 13
and Dominion.
Yeah,
Warehouse 13, Dominion. Yeah,
he's a good actor.
Repo: The Genetic Opera. He's really had a good career afterwards.
And Allison Hannigan. That was pretty much our start of her being popular too. And like I love her on she's like one of my celebrities that I would most likely to stalk. But How I Met Your Mother, I love that show.
She's great, yeah.
I think you're talking about the episodes dedicated to a specific character. I think one of my favorite episodes was one where they were afraid Xander was going to get hurt, so they like wouldn't tell him what they were doing. And he's going through this whole adventure on his own while they're fighting some kind of like giant tentacle demon that you just keep seeing just clips of them getting into. And the shit that he's like supposedly safe from is probably worse than what they're fighting.
Yeah, it's a great episode. It's called The Zeppo, in honor of Zeppo Marx, of course, who was the third Marx brother. But that episode is fantastic. I mean, you got a good classic car in there. You've got
that's one of my
kind
dream
of a
cars.
Nerdy skateboarder, you know, kind of guy coming up and emerging as a real hero. And the beauty of it is that no one knew it.
Yeah, it's like he did all this stuff, and everyone's like,
no one had no idea. And so that kind of was a good. That was a really good kind of spring forward for the rest of the series for him, is that he was important. He was relevant. He wasn't just third wheel in their whole little, or fifth wheel in their whole little group.
And also Seth Green, too, is Oz. I like
my favorite
character
Buffy character is Seth Green.
He was so zen about everything. It didn't matter what was going on. He's like, whatever, man.
Yeah,
we'll just
peace,
do it.
Love, happiness.
Whatever, man. You know,
he's like a hippie werewolf. He was just...
Yep. Became a werewolf by getting a little bite on the finger from his newborn infant cousin.
weird. I forgot that was like his origin story.
Out of all the danger and everything, his infant cousin, who happened to be the spawn of werewolf.
Yeah, you know, it happens.
Talking to his aunt on the phone, he's like, really? So how long has that been going on now? Oh, pretty much all your life. Okay, great. Yeah, once a month, got to lock myself up, guys. That's it.
Watch out for those moon phases. They can be a bitch.
Yeah. Werewolfism, the weirdest sexually transmitted disease.
It is truly the gift that keeps on giving.
So what's your probably favorite... Any highlights come to mind on Buffy?
Oh, my favorite episode of Buffy? Well, just I'll give you my favorite episode. I really like season 5 quite a bit. Had the little sister character. I don't want to spoil too much. It's been off the air for almost 10 years, guys. So.
And that was random, too, when she showed up. You're like, what? She's got a sister? What the hell did this come from?
And the fact that it was of mystic origin was just awesome. I love that. You know, because you know how shows do. They'll change characters between episodes sometimes and be like, wait, man, I'm supposed to believe that that's now that? No.
Yeah.
It actually had a really good backstory.
They just popped that up. I mean, you didn't figure out how she was there until much later, but like her first episode is just like, it's like the tail end of, it might have even been like a season ending or a season premiere, and it's like, she's got a sister now? When the hell did this happen?
She actually was emerged in season 5, and they hinted about her in the end of season 3. So that was not a random thing. That was coming. I mean, that was a whole
plan. A little bit of foreshadowing there.
Yeah, it was some great foreshadowing. And it was very poetic, and it was literally poetic because it was a poem by the character Faith, and her and Buffy having a dream sequence. And they said, you know, Little Miss Muffet in 720, and, you know, and 2 years later to the day, Dawn shows up on the screen. So Joss knows what he's doing, man. He's got a brain the size of Texas.
He plots that stuff out deep, and, too.
But yeah, I'd have to say The Gift, the season ender for season 5, which was supposed to be the series finale because it wasn't sure if they were coming back.
That's when it went to the other network, went from whatever, CW to UPN.
WB
to CW, yeah. Or UPN. UPN.
UPN, yeah.
God, there was so many of them back then.
Yeah.
But WB's chain name like 5 times. There's a lot of good metaphors in that episode. There's personal sacrifice, family above all.
Yeah, because if they didn't come back, that was a good way to end the show. Was that final sacrifice to save her sister and save the world?
Yeah, it was, and it just kind of really drove home the character of Buffy. You know, despite the corny Southern California name, and you sit in these panels and people talk about, well, my favorite character was Willow, my favorite character was Xander. They were so much better than Buffy. I said, yeah, but they don't have the title of their name in the title of the show.
Yeah,
there's a reason for that. She is the hero. She's the one.
Yeah, she's the one and that has to.
She made
do
the
ultimate
hard sacrifice, so therefore she will always be the leader of the pack.
That show had just great like deep character. Like when. Her mother dies in the series. I mean, that's something you really didn't see on a, quote unquote, young person's show.
And again, the way she died amidst all the peril and
all the bad shit that's happened.
She just died of natural causes.
Yeah.
It's the same way people die every day. So
that was one thing I liked in the later seasons, too. They kind of showed her. I mean, it takes that's job of being the Slayer has to take its toll. And there's almost like a post-traumatic stress with her, like as the series goes on, you see it start getting harder and harder for her to be the hero,
right? And it's untreatable for Buffy too. People bring up PTSD a lot of times when we have like scholars and stuff on panels at DragonCon. You know, we've had people that were PhDs in psychology and stuff, and they would say, you know, oh, she's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I said, I think at this point it's become a permanent personality trait, so she's never going to be cured of it.
I mean,
so,
this is just your way of life. It's all you've known.
So yeah, the monsters are still going to come no matter what. What you do
at that point, the show is not about suffering and the struggle. It's about coping and dealing and growing from that point. So that's why I like the series a lot. And the writers, Marty Knox and Jane Espenson, they all did a great job writing Buffy when Joss broke away to do another show.
Yeah, or what we'll be talking about next, Angel. But he even continued once Buffy was off there. The last season he did as a comic book. Mm-hmm. So I've read
last
a couple
two seasons.
Of them.
Season 8 and season 9 are both in comics. Season 10 is in print, I believe, or it's on its way. I've read season 8, most of season 9. Believe it or not, the comics are okay. I'm not a comic book guy to begin with. So, I mean, I grew up reading, the stock, common comics that everybody does. But I don't really do anything comics these days. So, at my house, you'll find a lot of Buffy, a lot of Firefly comics, and some Predator and Alien stuff, too, from Dark Horse. But the comics books were a little cheesy. I mean, they did keep the storyline intact. They did keep the customers. The characters and everything. They did keep everything the way that it was left, and they kind of expanded, but some of the things they did in the comics were things they couldn't do in the series.
Yeah.
Like characters being turned into giants and
kind of a different centaurs, direction. Yeah.
You know, stuff's going to get weird when you start doing comic books.
So there's a little bit of a hokiness, but again, you know, comic and print has always had a lot of the ability to take a lot of liberties with characters because, you know, there's no special effects involved other than just an extra few extra pin strokes. So, yeah, I mean,
yeah, I haven't been up with comics in a while. I gotta check some of that stuff out. And he's done, like, Josh has done a bunch of comics. I mean, he wrote some Astonishing X-Men for a while. Yeah, like I said, he's done Firefly, Angel, Buffy comics.
Yeah, I mean, there's been novel video games even. You know,
the Runaways. So. He did the Runaways comic, which is a good comic.
Yeah. Well, let's move on into Angel and Mr. J. August Richards, where we first meet Gunn.
So Angel, the spinoff that came out after season 4 of Buffy ended with David Boreanaz, who of course was the recurring character of Angel on Buffy, was a big bad, was her boyfriend, was an ally, was an enemy.
Yeah, I mean, he goes from being the good guy to the bad guy for a season and is dead for a while and then comes back. And
right. I mean, Angel is the Angel is his name. He's an ensouled vampire who's, when he's not ensouled, his name is Angelus. Before that, he was Liam the Human from Galway, Ireland.
Yeah, an Irishman.
He was kind of a rich boy, you know, grew up whoring and drinking his way through life. And then, you know,
as you're known to do,
became a vampire, you know, through some woman that tricked him into some whoring and drinking and made a vampire pet out of him. And he became
if you're going to be whoring and drinking, do not become a vampire, folks.
Right. And he became one of the most bloodthirsty, ruthless, meanest vampires in vampire history.
As good as Good Angel is, Bad Angel is just nasty.
Yeah. So he bit the wrong person one time, bit a little Romanian girl, and was by her grandmother, who happened to be a gypsy witch, cursed him with a soul. Using a object called the Orb of Thessala. And that was a very poignant moment in his life, and he became a vampire who immediately had remorse for every bad thing that he did in his entire life. So if you can imagine, you know, how guilty you guys feel in your everyday lives, that was super guilty. So and then so he helped Buffy, and he was lurking around Sunnydale. His mission was to actually help the Slayer. And then, you know, through certain events in the series, he ended up in Los Angeles, starting his own little angel detective agency.
Yeah, that was cool, because basically part of the curse is if he ever, whatever, has a true moment of happiness, he'll lose his soul and go back to being evil. So,
that's right.
Yeah, after he meets Buffy and falls in love with her, he can't handle it, because if he ever hooks up with her totally, he's going to turn evil again.
Yeah, Buffy
so
had
he finds like, I got to go, I got to get away.
Buffy had the combination of that safe.
She knew the Konami code for his soul.
That's it. To the up, up, down, down, left, right, be a angel. So, yeah, that was exactly what happened. Buffy and Angel had sex in Buffy, and, you know, Angel became Angelus. So, you know. So there's a lot of jokes around that, around the Whedonverse. I don't, you know, just some of them get really nasty, but, you know. So. It was his soul was in his semen? No, there's just there's just things like that we have during discussion.
Oh, yeah, mine too, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most guys don't call you the next day.
Yeah. Because I think there's an episode of the Angel series where he has sex with some girl, but he doesn't turn evil, and she's like, aren't you supposed to turn evil when you have sex? He's like, no, just when I have, like, you know, true happiness.
Only if it makes me happy.
Get out!
Your money's on the dresser. Get out.
Yeah.
The ultimate walk of shame, folks.
Yeah, you're not good enough to turn me evil. But yeah,
you're
thanks
not
for,
his
night.
Boyfriend or her, his girlfriend.
Oh, that's yeah, great. I love that show because I mean it was a little bit more serious than Buffy.
It's darker,
and so it was like a almost a detective, you know, film noir feel to it. I mean, yes, he is a vampire, but it's almost like just a straight up detective show. At least that first couple seasons.
And again, with the secondary and tertiary characters, some of which carried over from Buffy to Angel, and I mean, just really good. I mean, I think some of the character development in Angel is even better than some of the stuff in Buffy.
Because
I mean,
Cordelia, I like that character much more on Angel than I did on
right.
On
and you're supposed
Buffy.
To. You're supposed to take her more.
She,
seriously
she grew
as
up
an adult.
And became like a you know, well rounded adult instead of just the spoiled child she always was on Buffy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, she was much more likable in the series, and they did a lot of great things with her character.
And even his whatever sidekick that had the visions from the first season.
Doyle.
Yes, yeah, Doyle.
Doyle who had visions, yeah.
Originally was on Roseanne as...
Glenn Quinn, yes. Yeah. Mark. Yeah.
As we know, Josh, some of his early writing credits was a writer for Roseanne.
That's right. During the last season of the Roseanne, he wrote all of Darlene's lines. Go figure. Really? Sarcastic, snarky, you know, starting to see a pattern. But yeah, he was. That was one of his first big gigs after graduating from Wesleyan. And
Now that I know that he wrote for Darlene, that makes so much sense, that character now.
Yeah, great actress too, by the way, Sarah Gilbert. Yeah. She's still, to this day, a great actress, and she always plays a similar role. So they really picked a good writer for her in that series. But back to Angel. Angel was a really good series. You didn't know who the evil was going to be. I mean, it had lawyers and spies and
Wolfram and Hart,
SWAT teams and hell, and I mean, just the streets of L.A. And sometimes the evil characters were not even mystical or anything. They just were humans and they had ties. And
that was the coolest thing, that the big demon, the bad guy, was a law firm. I mean, it makes so much sense.
Right. No, it wasn't just a law firm. It was the demonic law firm.
It was a law firm that was older than the history of Earth itself. Yeah. And multi-dimensional law firm, because they existed in multiple dimensions.
Yeah. Weren't actual monster demon. They were just straight-up lawyers. They just happened to work for this demonic entity.
But apparently they controlled the world and everybody in it. So it was a really good premise for a show. I think for me, Angel was very successful as a series. It ended in season 5. Ratings kind of dwindled off towards the latter seasons, but honestly, the fan following that Angel has is not quite as vocal as the ones that Buffy and Firefly and other shows do. But man, when you sit down and talk with a bunch of Angel fans, it's like time just disappears.
Yeah. I mean, it really didn't get the respect that Buffy did when it first came out, but because it was really a different show, and some of the people that were hardcore Buffy fans didn't really get it at first. But yeah, it definitely picked up a big following. You see that with a lot of Josh's stuff. I mean, they're Whedon fans.
He's definitely got a cult following.
Yeah, I mean, more so than most fandoms. You see people who are fans of how long has Firefly been off there, and you see brown coats at every convention you go to. I mean, he inspires a passionate following on all his projects.
Yeah, he really does. And it's really hard. What's funny is it's really hard to please us, but it's really easy to let us down. That's really kind of the mantra of a Whedon fan. We're not that hard to please, as long as Joss is somewhat whispering in someone's ear, at least we're happy. Yeah. But to let us down is much easier. Angel really let us down because it ended before we feel like we got everything that we needed. I mean, they did get a chance to, the series was announced during the mid-season break that they were going to go ahead and cancel it, so that gave the writers and the directors and stuff a chance to say, okay, let's do this. Joss came back, he was involved in a few other things at the time, and he came back and he said, all right, let's end this thing. And I'm very pleased with the ending. Fade to Black
There's going to be a whole.
I'm sorry, my Metallica and my Whedon fandom just cross streams there.
Same thing. Yeah.
Not Fade Away is the last episode of Angel, not Fade to Black. But anybody, feel free to vid that, because that would be fantastic. It's fitting. But
the big bad apocalyptic battle, and we just kind of, it ends with them, the battle fixing to start. So you really don't see the outcome, so you can kind of imagine however you want to imagine. But I do like his final line. It's like, what are we gonna do? He's like, I don't know about y'all, but I've always wanted to slay a dragon.
Let's go to work. Yeah. Let's go to work. Credits. It was so bad, and then guess what? It faded to black. So that was a great series. They went a lot of different places with a lot of characters. There was a large theme of redemption in that series. The redemption was kind of the overlying theme. It was the storm cloud that kept the city dark, really.
And that's the we hadn't really talked about him, but Spike too, through both series. Yep. I love the arc of his character, from being the bad guy to being a good guy, and then eventually joining Angel, and it turned into like a buddy cop movie at that point, when it was Spike and Angel.
It's the only series, if you will, it's the only series that can pull off changing two main characters into foam puppets and felt puppets.
Yes, I almost forgot that episode.
And being fun. Oh, actually, it only changed Angel into a puppet. I'm thinking of Puppet Spike from some other fan film thing that I saw. But that's the only series that got away with turning Angel into a Sesame Street puppet and me loving it. So,
and for a vampire, he always had some, like, I don't know. I think they have done a Supernatural puppet thing.
Yeah, no, they have. You can go to Dragon Con and for $125, you can get puppet angel. And people drop $125 on this puppet angel. I'm like, sorry, folks, I got like a mortgage and cars, yeah. card notes to pay. And so puppet angel, maybe someday. Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to the next one there, which would be probably the biggest Whedon thing that everyone always wants to bring up, but was probably the shortest lived, which was Firefly.
My love. I love Buffy. I love Angel. I love Dollhouse. I love all of Dr. Horrible. I love everything Whedon's done, but Firefly does hold a special place with me. I've had a lot of involvement with the Firefly community, working on podcasts, doing shindigs and movie screenings and little charity here and there, charity work in the name of Serenity here and there. Firefly was a space western.
Yeah. John Wayne in space. That's pretty much
it. It was a space western, and it was set 500 years in the future after we kind of used up the Earth. We had to start, terraforming and colonizing the other planets around the solar system. And some of them were really well, it's a lot like the Star Wars universe where you have some planets that are very well developed and then you have some planets that are just desolate outlands.
That was the thing, because it wasn't like, say, Star Trek, where it's everything's super high tech.
Yeah.
Not everything looked, well-worn and homemade. It was definitely a frontier environment.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're talking about a television show that has trains and horses and, cowboy-style figures and, gunfights and revolvers and stuff. And then all along, spaceship comes along in the middle and joins in the fight.
You could edit out the spaceships and it would play as a straight up western.
Yeah, pretty good western. Yeah, a lot of bar fights and things. So whorehouses.
Gotta love brothels.
The episode where they were defending the whorehouse was
Heart of Gold. That's a great episode. So, but yeah, the thing about Firefly is that it's funny. It's only ran for 13 episodes. They aired out of order in 2002. Then a Dan Cortez show replaced it. Some show with Dan Cortez and Bill Bellamy where they drove around fast cars and stuff. It was, I can't remember what it was, but it pissed me off because I went to check my DVR from Friday night because it aired on Friday nights, which was not a good night for sci-fi back then. And I was like, what the fuck is this Dan Cortez pissing all over my Firefly hour? And
That was painful.
So I never really got to watch the entire series when it first aired. I only saw two episodes. The first two that they aired out of order. So until it came out on DVD, I'd never seen the rest of the series.
Yeah, I think I hadn't seen it since until it came out on Netflix.
One of the crazy things about Firefly, as far as a TV series, it never, received all that great ratings, but the DVD sales of it were actually, phenomenal.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the cult following was big enough that it finally did get a movie at least.
That's right. 2005 Serenity came through because of the internet. Thank you, guys.
Yeah.
Basically said, we want our movie. And so what we got as a movie was actually season two of Firefly.
Yeah, so, I read that Josh tried to take all those storylines that were going to be the whole next season and refigure them into the movie.
He wrote it as a two-season series. So we got the two seasons. And I would tell you, man, when Serenity came out, Serenity to this day is my favorite movie of all time. And I'm a little biased, so I do have other movies I like a lot. Like, I could sit and watch Aliens trilogy with you all. Or I say trilogy. I know there's more than three, but there's three.
Three good ones.
And all day long, Terminator. I could watch all the Terminator movies and know them as well as I do Firefly and Serenity. But Serenity is one of the few movies that when I watch it, I still do really get goosebumps. The message in the movie is anything.
That speech he gives River at the end, before they're taken off, if that doesn't like make you feel a little bit, you're a heartless bastard.
Love
will keep her in the air.
Yeah, love's what keeps her flying. You don't love a ship, she'll sink you faster than anything. I mean, I know I'm fudged that up a little bit, but
it's like love will keep her flying when she ought to fall. And I gotta watch that again.
It's not much. It's enough. I mean, it's a little dialogue like that. But you're talking about a series that's serious, compelling, funny.
Yeah,
you got good looking guys, good looking women. You got all kinds of just strange things happening: gunfights, bar fights, intrigue, spies. The government is like this giant evil government, and they're trying to control everybody. Much like in the Hunger Games, everybody talks about the Hunger Games. The government's much like it is in Firefly. So, and these guys are just outlaw pirates, basically riding along on a little space pirate ship, running illegal cargo.
He's basically Han Solo. Very Millennium Falcon. If he never joined the rebellion, this is what Han would be doing, just trying to make a living.
And just for the record, Mao always shoots first. It was never a debate. He always shoots first. That's what he does.
There's one episode where somebody's holding somebody hostage, and he just comes like walking in and shoots the guy in the head with like no negotiating whatsoever. It's like, toss the body. We got to get out of here.
Toss him out. Got to get out of here. And that the reason he was so eager to get out of here is because of Reavers, which is the other thing. The thing about Firefly and Serenity.
Zombies in space, pretty much.
Is that you have the space series. And we've had so many space series come across television, you know, all with aliens. Firefly has no aliens in it whatsoever. None. No. And most people don't realize that until you say it out loud. But there's no aliens. So they're... It's so funny because it's humans versus humans, and then you got this third party that comes in called Reavers. Reavers are genetic mutants. They're humans that were mutated because the government tried to give the populace drugs and they know it's best for us and everything. And guess what? It didn't take very well for about 4% of the population. They became like zombies.
Who would have imagined the government getting that wrong?
Yeah. So they became zombies that knew how to fly spaceships.
For the people who didn't just die off, they became like these flesh-eating monsters. And, there's so much great stuff. And that's pretty much we'd seen Nathan Fillion before, and he was a good bad guy in Buffy for a little bit. But, I mean, that was the first time we really seen him as a hero. I mean, we wouldn't have had Castle or any of the other great stuff we've had since then without his impression he made on Firefly.
Nicholas Brendon was who played Xander on Buffy was the original lead intent by Joss for that series.
That would have been weird.
And to this day, I bet you Nicholas Brendon just does not like Nathan Fillion because he came on as Caleb in season 7 of Buffy, and that's what got him
poked his eye out.
Well, actually, he had already gotten the job before that. He got the Caleb gig as a result of the Firefly gig, but because he was auditioning for the role of Caleb,
he made such a good bad guy too in that as Caleb.
He was such a lovable captain in Firefly too. I mean, and you're talking about a guy that was a sergeant in the Resistance, so he wasn't a commissioned officer.
No.
He didn't have all this military, and he calls himself a captain of the ship because he holds the freaking papers to it.
Yeah,
but
he doesn't have any real.
So
like,
he kind of fumbles his way through it. You can tell he has really no leadership skills whatsoever. I mean, and he just fumbles his way through it. And that's part of the beauty of the series is that. He's flawed. He's imperfect. He messes up. He gets in fights. He gets beat.
They lose occasionally. There's not a happy ending to every episode.
And to spoil this series as well, the Resistance that he was a part of lost the war against the Alliance. Yeah. So he already knows what it's like to taste the sting of defeat. It actually follows him around like a ghost.
So. And of course, the hero, Canton Jayne.
Mr. Adam Baldwin.
I love that. That was one of my...
no relation to the other ones.
One of my answers of like, which fictional character would you want to meet the most? I'm like, I would like to hang out with him, man. We could smoke some cigars and get drunk and get in a gunfight. I mean, it would probably
compare
be a good
knives,
time.
Compare knives, compare guns. That'd be me.
It would be an awesome night.
Yeah, no, Adam Baldwin, man, he really cinched that character right up, man. I mean, if anybody's familiar with any of his other work, I mean, he was Animal Mother in Full Metal Jacket. He was Casey and Chuck. I mean, he really kind of
rewatched Chuck recently. He was so good as Casey in that.
He's, you know, and you talk about characters. I mean, I'm talking about actors at conventions. He was a fun person to actually sit next to on a panel. And
it's almost impossible to get into one of his panels when he's at Dragon Con. He's like the star. I like his new show too, Last Ship. I mean, that's been a fantastic show.
Yeah, I've been watching that one, and I love his character because he's sort of that same tuned up kind of macho guy, but. He still remembers he's got structure.
Yeah.
He's got a regimented, you know, chain of command. He's got to follow.
Still smokes cigars, too.
Still smokes cigars, though. And
that's someone we need on the podcast.
And the last ship gets mega points for showing the freaking rapper, man.
Yeah.
Macanudo all day, baby. That was awesome.
Yeah, we got to find him at Dragon Con. We got to get him on the podcast. We'll be like, hey, cigar nerds, man, you're perfect. You're a nerd.
You're our people.
Yes.
That's a real life thing, too. He actually does.
Oh,
he does burn sticks in the real world, too.
Like I said, if he's there, we need to do the Cigar Nerds panel at Dragon Con. We'll get Adam in to smoke with
It'll
us.
Have to be an outdoor panel, so that's cool.
Hey,
we'll just do it on Peachtree Street. We'll close Peachtree Street.
As long as I get an excuse to smoke with Adam Baldwin, it's all good. Well, I mean, that's another thing, too, about Firefly. It was kind of shot... It looked almost like a documentary style. It wasn't like fancy and stuff. It had that real gritty look to it.
Yeah, the set was really, it's really cool. The set was a little darker because, you know, you're in space. You had a little bit of ambient white noise. So
yeah, I mean, almost like a reality show.
Yeah, it was. And you know what's funny is the set got torn down before the movie and they rebuilt the exact same set again.
Yeah, because you couldn't tell a difference that that's not the same.
It was really good.
Same
really
ship.
That's awesome.
And the set was full size. It was actually laid out like the ship, full size.
Nice. And, well, the next big thing, since we're not really going to get into Avengers or Agent Shield, because we already covered that in previous episodes, but Dollhouse was, I mean, that's another one of those short-lived Josh series.
Yeah, Dollhouse was a great series. I'm actually a very big fan of Dollhouse, huge fan, more so than a lot of Whedon folks you'll meet. Dollhouse was a little hard to Eliza follow Descu. For some people. And you know what, goes beyond her. I will say a little bit about Eliza later, about why the series is so brilliant because of her. She played Faith on Buffy, a very shallow, surface-laden character who had nothing but violence as a motivator, really, for her.
And anyone that's not seen this series, basically people, anyone who's in some bad shit or something can basically sign your life away for a 5-year period, and they blank you out and basically make you a robot or a doll because you have no memories except what they implant to you, and then it's kind of like a high-class, you know, whorehouse. People can come in and say, hey, I need a computer tech, and they'll download this personality into you. Then all of a sudden this blank slate becomes a badass computer tech or assassin or a hooker, whatever the client
needs. Or even a lawyer. Needs.
Even I see that becoming a double-edged sword quick.
Yeah, even something as boring and arbitrary as a lawyer. Well, as with any technology implementation, you know that some things
eventually
go wrong.
Shit's going to go wrong.
One of the things that happened in the series was that traces of previous dolls were left, and you actually had multiple personalities.
Yeah, they went a full swipe. They started kind of building up,
and not in a schizophrenic state, but multiple personalities, all aware and cognizant at the same time.
Yeah, those skills and stuff that she had been implanted with were kind of combined in one character. And that was cool too. Like, especially she was like a different character each episode, so it definitely had a different.
Yeah, in some episodes she was multiple characters.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing I think that was Emmy-worthy about Eliza's performance is she may not be the greatest actress in a lot of things. I mean, you know, she all did True Calling, which was for her series that she led with Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah,
She was okay in that. I mean, it was a good show, good premise, but she was still Faith to me. I mean, one thing about Eliza Dushku, I don't know if you ever listened, but watch this before, but the girl, she has the same dance in everything that she's in. She always raises her arms up, and she does the same dance.
Yeah.
So she can't dance, and they always get her to dance. In Dollhouse, she could dance. She could dance wonderfully. You could tell that she'd been spending time with the coaches and everything, and she would be, like, really elegant in one episode, and a street urchin in the next, and a lawyer in the next, and then a hostage negotiator in the next.
Yeah.
And in every episode, it was really cool because she had to really span a breadth of characters and personalities to pull this off. And when you look at the special features on the DVDs and stuff, she did it without a lot of takes because they just didn't have time for her to do 20 takes on one scene. So they actually did a lot of, they limited scenes to 2 and 3 takes. And so that really speaks to an actor's, an actor's skill to, you got to pull it off and you have to be the best actor in the world today.
I mean, once they, all right, we're live and, the set goes, at that point you're on the payroll. Mm-hmm. So.
And, of course, Josh always likes to reuse some of the same cast. We had Amy Akers from Angel as the doctor on there.
Yeah,
and she was an interesting character that we find out later was another doll.
Right. Yeah, you had a lot of. I mean, Whedon alums show up in everything. I mean, you have a lot of things they show up in, Alan Tudyk.
Yeah,
Alan Tudyk was
the alpha.
That was probably my favorite episode. My favorite episode. He ends up being the big bad in the whole. Well, one of the big bads.
Yeah, I love him and everything he's been in. He is an awesome actor. He was even good in the last Batman movie.
he handed out some business cards one year at Dragon Con, and he actually handed me a business card, and it said "Professional Fool" in quotes. And I was like, "That's absolutely
awesome,"
because he's Steve the Pirate. He's Wash. And
I forgot about Steve Pirate. Steve.
Oh yeah, and then he was in A Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger.
Yeah,
I love that.
One of the Transformers movies.
He was in some movie. The title slips me now. Where he ends up naked on a roof because he's tripping on Percocets and stuff. I mean, so it was an English movie. He's Professional Fool. He's the class clown. So.
Josh and his horror, Buffy Angel, I mean, he wrote the Cabin in the Woods movie too, which was an awesome and a lot of, you know, other Whedon people was
Thor before he was Thor.
Yeah,
because you know that movie, I'll tell you, it was in the making since 2004. Yeah. He had been writing. He and Tim Minear had been writing it since 2004, and they tried several attempts to get it to theater before that. It finally came out around, I think it was 2011, 2012. What a great premise for a movie.
Yeah, because it's basically...
I did not see it coming.
It's awesome, you know, talking about some of our previous podcast episodes, the way that, you know, I mean, it was almost an attempt to almost revitalize the slasher film. And,
right.
And, I mean, you know, and even delve into, you know, adding a satirical...
that's why I love that movie.
...twist on the whole torture porn thing.
Yeah,
because it was... you know, basically the premises was there was some kind of ancient ritual that had to be performed every so often, and there was this whole corporation set up to have this this ritual happen. So they, you know, create a kind of almost a virtual environment where monsters can kill these kids.
Right.
Your traditional horror movie trope, and so without the hardcore horror stuff that's going on, you're also seeing these guys in an office somewhere monitoring the events and right. betting on which monster is going to kill somebody that's first.
Right. And they have a whiteboard and they're taking bets and pools. And I mean, it's basically, if you think about it, it's kind of like the Hunger Games meets the Running Man meets, Evil Dead 2. And honestly, when I first sat down, I was like, Cabin in the Woods. The first thing that came to my mind was like, you're not Evil Dead 2. Please don't try to redo Evil Dead 2. Cause you know, that's what it's off to. No, the cabin was just the title. It was actually not the center of the thing.
It was the
overlying conspiracy. And the fact that they're switching over to the Japan unit and showing them beating the Japan unit. I mean, it's a global conspiracy, and it's just fantastic.
Yeah, there's these little offices set up like throughout the world to see who makes sure as long as someone succeeds in the premises. Right. And of course, Thor before he was Thor as the jock boyfriend.
That's right. That's right. Some great scenes in that movie. You've got Topher from Dollhouse on there. He was just played one of the best stoners who I think is perpetual Shaggy from Scooby Doo.
Shaggy from Scooby Doo. His thermos that turns into a giant bong was just the funniest thing.
I mean,
it's like MacGyver. I mean, the character pulls up
to get in the RV and he turns around and he hits the fob on his car, makes sure it's locked and the window's down, and he's like, he walks away. It's the guy that just, you know, he's had a little bit too much of the weed.
Yeah, because he has this huge bong, and he's like, dude, you can't bring that along. He's like, don't worry. And it folds up into like a coffee mug.
Is there something we can take away from this film to have a, reinvent the portable humidifier? You know, or humidor, rather?
There you go. It's what you call a double-edged bong. You know, it's caffeine on one side and you know, herb out of the other.
Chris Hemsworth tries to escape on the motorcycle and he's like, the hero moment. I'm going to jump this this canyon and save us all. And then it hits the wall.
He got zapped like a bug.
Yes,
he hit the holographical wall. Oh, there's not a canyon there. It's a wall.
And when they find their way into the complex and start freeing all the monsters,
that's probably the best
scene right there.
That's Hollywood gold.
All the different monsters that they listed at the beginning when they were betting on which monster was going to be the killer. Oh, it was hysterical.
Yeah, it's awesome. And you know, you talk about guys and they look like IBMers or old NASA guys or shirts and ties talking about installing cabinets in their houses and stuff. And then, so it's a really cool movie. It goes in a lot of different directions and has a really good ending that it's still relatively new, so I won't spoil the ending, but it has a good ending that when I sat in the theater, I was like, wait a minute, it's over? I didn't see that coming. And
when you see the different countries, too, and their horror thing, the Japanese one was always like, it was weird, like The Grudge, and there's all these Japanese students and stuff.
Yeah,
it was
very much like The Grudge, you know, but... Cabin in the Woods is a must-see. If you got a good Friday night or Saturday night just to, you know, burn a movie and... you know, get some popcorn. It's good horror. It's not your traditional horror slasher fic. It's got a lot of conspiracy in it and makes you think a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely
check it out.
It's a good slasher movie, and then it's also a good comedic value, too.
A lot of monsters. A lot of monsters. A lot of cosplay opportunities in that film, too.
Oh, and back to Dollhouse, that also had Felicia Day in it, the final couple episodes. You know, it kind of got weird at the end of Dollhouse because they kind of had to shorten it up. So it takes this weird, like, you know, time jump. Like the last couple episodes are whatever years or months or however long into the future. When
again, Joss has been good shit's gotten at, all like, weird. Getting that letter saying your series is going to get canceled. So he's like, I get to end it though. So he ends it. Goes post-apocalyptic. He shows the aftermath of what happens when all that tech just finally comes up and bites us in the ass. And it's exactly like you think it would be. And, you know.
And, of course, it's not a Josh project without one of the main characters being killed off at some point.
That's right. That's right.
We've been placing bets on who's going to die in the next Avengers.
I love the joke. I think it was a T-Fury shirt one time which said, George R. R. Martin, Joss Whedon, and Stephen Moffat walk into a bar and kill everybody you love. The end.
that's an excellent. So,
I mean, there's so many recurring themes here. I mean, I think we could officially start the Josh Whedon, drinking game.
There probably is one.
You might end up dead after 5 minutes on that.
Every time a main character dies, take a shot.
There's some good drinking games out there. For Joss Whedon, we actually tried to sit down and write one at DragonCon 1 year, but then we got word that we weren't allowed to host drinking games at DragonCon. So that was dead before it started.
Just go to the steampunk panels. There's usually something.
It's cosplay over there. Drunkenness is cosplay.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a character. It's party Jabba. But another one of my favorite probably Whedon project. And this is the first time I saw Felicia Day was the Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog.
Oh, that's right. Dr. Horrible. So the story behind that is there's a writer's strike. Everybody remembers a writer's strike from a few years ago. And all the writers decided we're going to like not work and we're going to protest and we're going to strike. So during the writer's strike, though, everybody wanted to still keep working and everything. So Joss pulled together a lot of people for free. Everybody volunteered to be in this thing and made the first web series that he'd ever done called Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog, which was released in July of 2008. And starring Neil Patrick Harris as a very timid, shy, nerdy kind of guy.
Nerd by day, wannabe villain by night.
He's a genius who calls himself a doctor, but never really provided any credentials, you know, any PhD or anything.
He has a PhD in horribleness.
Yeah, that's a new catchphrase. But he decides he's just this, he wants to be an evil villain. I don't know what daddy issues such a nice young guy has to be an evil villain, but... And Nathan Fillion played the Captain Hammer, who's his nemesis, and Felicia Day, the love interest. And
Captain Hammer, even though he's supposed to be the hero, is such a dick. He's technically the hero, but you're like, screw that guy.
So you get Nathan Fillion again, you know, in being really just kind of playing Nathan Fillion more than anything. But the twist on this is that it's a musical, and you know, Joss has a very soft spot for musicals. It was a musical episode of Buffy, and he just really likes musicals. And The songs in this thing are hilarious.
They're freaking awesome.
And then
I've downloaded the soundtrack.
You get down there and you listen to the soundtrack and you learn all the songs and you sing them. You find yourself humming them, and then you get to listen to the commentary on the DVD, and it goes real dark, real fast, and it's so great.
I've got that DVD. I got to watch it again. I don't think I've listened to the commentary in a while. But yeah, the music on that was and like you said, he was kind of like, I want to do something without the Hollywood structure. I mean. It was during the writer's strike, so like, we're going to do this on our own without any kind of studio backing, and it was excellent.
Yeah, I mean, well, Time Magazine, you know, named it number 15 and, you know, the top 50 invention in 2008.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just freaking awesome the way that the film was able to be dubbed and the choreography and everything else came together. And
you know, I said that was my first love of Felicia Day was born with...
she was fantastic in that. Of course, she got her big break in Buffy, in season 7 of Buffy, as a potential Slayer by, and she's been in so many other things.
I loved her on Eureka.
Yeah, she's great on Eureka. She's a recurring character, excuse me, now on Supernatural. And
her Supernatural, especially the one where they're at the LARPing event, is hilarious.
Yeah, she's got quite a fan following. I've met Felicia a couple times in person. She's come to Dragon Con. We helped her celebrate her birthday 1 year, and
awesome,
you know. So it was a really cool. That was actually that year too. That was the year that was DragonCon 2008, and so it was really big. We did live performances of it at DragonCon. You know, Rocky Horror Picture Show style. And she came to one.
Yeah, I've got to make that. I haven't been to one of those yet, but it sounds like it'd be fun.
It's a real fun time. people have had so much fun with this one over everything. You know, you can sit down and have a Firefly discussion, and it's going to be serious the whole time. It's going to be serious. You get a little bit of tongue-in-cheek here and there. People can talk about Buffy, and it's going to be deep and, you know, philosophical and psychological. Everybody has fun with Dr. Horrible. There's really nothing serious about it. It's Joss getting to let his hair down and say, okay, Hollywood, I don't need you for 6 months. I can do this. I got friends in high places. And
Fillion's a good, arrogant, and just asshole.
And this the good thing about Dr. Horrible is it introduces us to the other brothers Whedon. You know,
Zach and Jed,
and of course Marissa Tancheron, who became a main writer on Dollhouse for a long time. She's you know, she was one of the main writers, and they just wrote all these great songs, and they had all this great time. I mean, they filmed them locations that were basically said, we'll let you have it for 3 hours. You can have the laundromat for 3 hours. And it was really cool. I mean, it's just funny. Neil Patrick Harris was already an emerging superstar on How I Met Your Mother and shifted gears into this.
And Harold and Kumar, I think, was like the first like big thing he had reemerged with.
But
and
everybody knows him very well for this. I mean, How I Met Your Mother, of course, first, but this is the second most notable thing. And
so many Dr. Horrible cosplays at Dragon Con too.
Yes, there are. And
I even have a fat Captain Hammer. I say it's after he was defeated and the depression set in. He gained a few pounds. That's my explanation of
Mr. Hammer. He's not captain anymore.
No,
he's been somebody demoted. Did Mr. Hammer.
All right, let's go around the table. What is your favorite song from Dr. Horrible? For me, I'll start off then while y'all think about it, is the Brand New Day song that he sings like after he decides that I'm going to kill Captain Hammer. I mean, it just goes like just dark and kind of a little bit rock and roll.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, you know, mine. I mean, I remember he's at the laundromat and he's, you know, singing about, you know, how he's going to capture his love interest and all the things he's going to do to achieve that. And
she'll dry her eyes when I hand her the keys to a brand new Australia, however that line goes.
Yeah, there's that's I like that one. I think I actually like the opener to the third episode where you just have the montage of all the characters and you know, the newscasters are in there and the movers and everything.
When they're preparing for the big the press conference or whatever.
You know, and I'll kind of say, too, I kind of like the whole homeless bit that, you know.
Everyone's a hero in their own way.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. Yeah. I mean, you know, it just kind of shifts. You're like, all right, what are you doing? Are you trying to do the, you know, a whole... All right, I'm really trying to support the homeless, but at the same time, I'm just going to randomly drop in there that, hey, I just banged the chick sitting right here. Let's give her a warm welcome, folks.
Sort of a nerdy thing. Not my usual, but nice.
So, yeah. The second time around, they let you do the weird stuff.
Yeah. We do the weird stuff.
Yeah, the fan boys.
That's about the point that Rachel walked in, and she said, wait a second. The second time? No, you were the first time. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, yeah. And my favorite moment, too. These are not the hammer.
this is not the hammer. The hammer is my penis. The fact that he comes in to reiterate.
Yes, just to make sure.
Just to let
you know what he was saying.
The double entendre is no. Yeah, I'm talking about my dick. You know?
Yeah.
That's classic Captain Hammer because he's so dense, man.
Anyway. As we're getting ready to wrap this up, let's go around the table again. Favorite Joss Whedon, you know, moment, episode, show, comic, what? Brad, what you got for us?
I mean, I'm going to have to say, for me personally, just because, you know, back in the whole Buffy heyday and everything, unfortunately, I didn't catch a lot of it. You know, I was in and out of school all the time, full time. So, you know, for me, I think kind of going back and revisiting Dr. Horrible, I got to say, is probably one of the ones that really stands out. I mean, you know, it's got a lot to offer. So, I mean, I just like the sheer fact that it's all over the place.
Yeah.
When?
For me, I did mention that my favorite movie of all time was Serenity, so I'll kind of put that to the side. And for me, if I was to pick a favorite episode of any of the television series, you know, I really did like Out of Gas from Firefly only because it showed so many – it had flashbacks, and you got character origins, and you kind of got the way that they came together, how they got on the ship, and how they found each other, and, you know. And I really think that was good because, for me, that showed a lot of cohesion, how the family – that the Firefly family became a family. And we didn't get that in a lot of shows. We didn't ever see how the Star Trek crew came to know each other and everything. So I really did enjoy that quite a bit because it was really good writing.
Yeah, I think for me it has to be Angel was my probably favorite show growing up, because it was more of a guy show than Buffy. Like I said, that's probably going to do it for us. I just want to thank you for being here today, sir.
No problem. Yeah, my pleasure.
He was actually our first letter of someone who actually listened to the show and let us know we weren't talking to ourselves in the basement. So
it's awesome glad to know that there are actually people in the nerd cave. You know, it's crazy. I mean, hangs out at the local cigar shop that we do and everything. So, I mean, it just worked out perfectly.
And I said, we'll wrap this up, and you'll be back for our nerd news segment where we talk a little bit about some nerd music, and we'll be back here in a few minutes with our Beer 30. Any final thoughts there, Brad?
Well, I mean, as far as the episode goes and everything, really appreciate you being on the show today and everything.
Pleasure.
It was awesome to get your feedback, your expertise. Just a note on the cigar, real quick. Dude, I'm down to the last third now on this bad boy. And the full bodiness and everything is really showing its face right now. So I gotta say, this is an ecstatic and phenomenal smoke.
Yeah, it's definitely a strong one. So if you're a light smoker, be warned. But it's holed up good. And I think that'll do it for us. We'll be back here in a minute with some Beer 30.
Stay tuned.
Well, this is great. I wish I could stay and chit chat.
Well, it sure was nice to meet you, Doctor. You got a little crush, don't you, Doc? Well, that's gonna make this hard to hear. See, later I'm gonna take little Penny back to my place. Show her the command center, hammer cycle, maybe even the hamjet. You think she likes me now? I'm gonna give Penny the night of her life just because you want her. And I get what you want. See, Penny's giving it up. She's giving it up hard. Because she's with Captain Hammer. And these are not the hammer. The hammer is my penis.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to Beer 30. Time for us to pour some beers.
I think they've already been poured, sir.
We're getting ahead of ourselves then. What are we trying today, Brad?
We are trying the St. Bernardus Triple. It is an Abbey Ale, and I've got to say, it is delicious.
Yeah, Triple, if you're not not familiar with what that is, Triple is referenced as part of the brewing process where they actually use three times the amount of malt than they normally would in a Trappist beer. And Trappist beers are called so because they are brewed by Trappist monks in Belgium.
Yeah, I got to say, I've had a few of the other St. Bernardus beers, and I've always been a big fan of theirs. And, I like the fact that here we were able to get one of each of their beers as well as a really awesome chalice. So
we may have future St. Bernardus beers since we have an entire sampler of them now.
Yeah, but, it says here that this is a traditional Abbey Ale brewed in the classic triple style of Belgium's best Abbey Ales. It is blonde to pale amber in color with a wonderful head, slightly seed aroma, and orange grassy flavors of hops in the finish.
Yeah, it's brewed in Brouwerij St. Bernardus, Belgium, if I'm pronouncing any of that right. Which, like I said, this is
I need to do that in your best German accent.
Yeah, I don't have a German accent.
Okay, cool. Well,
this is brewed in Belgium by Trappist monks.
You might want to shave that mustache, my friend.
Well, just because I was watching whatever Iron Skies the other night. It's not, no. That's a movie you should check out. If you wanted to see a movie about space Nazis, Iron Skies is absolutely hilarious.
So Nazi vampires from outer space just isn't going to do it?
No, it's about apparently the Nazis fled to a moon base after World War II, and now they're finally reinvading the Earth after 50, 60 years, however long it's been.
I mean, I just want to say for the record, how many other podcasts do you go from, oh, let's talk about this beer? Well, now we're going to talk about Nazis.
Yeah, this beer is it gets like a 90 out of 100 on Beer Advisor. Like I said, the has a sweet malty taste with Belgium yeast and a toffee, hints of toffee, they say.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I think this is going back. We can't stress it enough, folks, that You know, when you're trying beers, you know, always try to pair the beer with a proper glassware as well as the temperature. So I personally think this beer is a little bit warm. You know, we picked it up probably an hour and a half or so ago, and it was not refrigerated previously. So, you know, I think it probably could have used another hour to come down in temperature just a little bit more.
So we rushed it a little.
Yeah, I think we rushed it, but, you know, between the beer and the cigar, I think we got a pretty good pairing here. I mean, the warmer it gets, you definitely pick up on the more citrus notes of the hops.
Yeah. It's definitely lighter than what we have been drinking in previous episodes, but it's good.
I mean, it's but
it's a little bit more fruity taste
in comparison,
than,
though. I mean, for the folks that are used to a lot of the domestic beers and stuff, I mean, I would say folks would probably see this on the heavier side if they're not used to drinking, you know, the crafts, the...
It's definitely a good starter beer for people who aren't you know deep into the craft brew. It's not as bitter as some of the other craft aren't. It's still, and it's 8% too. So yeah, if you start drinking this after you've been drinking Bud Light, you're gonna end up on the floor in like a couple beers.
Are watching a NASCAR race?
Yeah. Oh yeah, like I said, the Saint Bernard's, you can't go wrong. Like I said, I've tried a few of their flavors, and they're always turn out pretty good. And
yeah, I don't know. I guess it's just me, but I seem to be pretty you know partial to some of the Tapest, and they turn out a phenomenal product. I mean, I've had some beers that weren't quite my forte, but you know I could still appreciate them for the time, the effort, and just the quality of beer that was coming out of the bottle.
Hey, it's made by monks. It's got to be good because it's you know all been blessed and stuff, probably.
Yeah, dude. I mean, it's kind of like kosher, right? Yeah. I mean, wait. That's so is this like a religion. Holy beer then?
It might be. Yeah, you know, like I said, it's.
I mean, is this almost like the Vampire Slayer beer that we had last? The Halloween before last. You know, that said it was brewed with holy water.
Hey, that one you can also use as a weapon because you can throw the holy water on the demons and the vampires and you splash your beer on them and.
I mean,
and, take
I'm
care
pretty
of
sure I would still classify that as a party foul. I mean, a vampire gets a hold of you, the worst that happens is you're going to be drinking beer and a combination of blood for the rest of your eternal life. You're probably going to be spending a bit more time in the dark, but for a guy that works overnight, you could probably make that work for yourself.
I mean, hey, we're in the basement, so we don't get a lot of sunlight anyway, so, I mean, being a vampire can't be that bad.
As long as you don't glow in the daylight.
Yeah, as long as you're not one of those sparkly, you know, freaking Twilight vampires, as long as you're like a real, like, Dracula rip-your-throat-out vampire, then it's all good.
So you just went all Dracula 2000 on me.
Dude, Dracula 2000 was actually a good movie.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty... You know, I really thought that movie had a really awesome soundtrack.
I mean, I thought it was going to be cheesy because it had like... I mean, it had... How was it? Like bad pop singer in it that... Jerry Ryan from Voyager.
But I don't know,
it was
dude,
actually
pretty
good.
You're all about the cheesy pop singers. I got nothing on that one. Not enough distortion in their guitars for my taste.
Yeah. All right, I guess about wraps us up on this Beer 30. We'll be back with some science.
Stay tuned.
Yes, science! And welcome back. Time for some science. You ready to get some knowledge, Brad?
I mean, every episode, it seems you ask me the same question. Every episode, I tell you that, okay, you know what? I'm ready.
Wow, really? You're finally ready to get some knowledge? Well, have you ever heard the term white noise?
I mean, in the audio production world, absolutely.
I mean, it's something, you know, like you said, it's a kind of a noise-canceling sound that is like the opposite of another sound and is kind of is neutral. Well, scientists are trying to come up with that, but for smells.
So... Mm-hmm. I no longer have to hear your smells is what you're telling me?
No, you know how no longer have to smell my smells. Because Dr. Lav Varshi...
Hold on. I just want to give thanks to whoever has invented said technology.
Well, I'm trying to tell you that if you'd shut the hell up. Dr. Lav Varshi of the University of Illinois is trying to develop what they call olfactory white noise. You know, like it's different than, say, traditional... smell covering up, which just kind of perfume it with a different smell like deodorant and air freshener and whatnot.
But, and Axe body spray for all you teenagers out there listening to the podcast, which everyone actually hates. It's not like the commercials. Let me go ahead and tell you.
Yeah, and like if you go to different cons, you will smell enough Axe body spray. Axe body spray does not take the place of a shower. I'm just telling you that right now. But no, basically they've come up with a whole database of smells, like what the actual components and chemicals that make up different smells. Like, you know,
kind of like, it's almost like a scientific mathematical formula.
Yeah, pretty much. Kind of like when we smell something. Oh, we smell a hamburger. Well, say dogs, they smell each individual piece. They're like, we smell bread, meat. You know, they break it down. And that's basically what he is doing here with his study, is coming up with a database of what causes, you know, what is made up in the smell that we smell. And each thing has a different rating. So, and he's actually coming up with
like an offensive rating, or like just its own.
Like the chemicals,
this is,
and you know, the chemicals and the components of it, and have found smells that are the exact opposite of those. So when they combine, they'll cancel each other out and produce a neutral smell.
Interesting.
So instead of just trying to cover up stuff, so you know, you spray your Febreze and it smells like
so I'm looking here.
Flowers,
so
now it'd be like completely canceled.
You know,
out.
Looks like using this model, there's a blend of 38 compounds that can almost completely cancel out pungent odors of onion, sauerkraut, Japanese fermented tuna. I mean,
and
what
poop.
Is the difference between Japanese fermented tuna and American fermented tuna?
One of them has a slight accent.
Okay. I'll go with it.
But, I mean, this could work.
I guess this is still technically a family-friendly show, so we'll just... Folks, use your own imagination.
Yeah, because sometimes when you try to cover up smells, it doesn't work. It just smells like ass, and then whatever you've combined to try to cover it up. But like I said, say in industrial applications, like, you know, I know in certain areas, like we live near a chicken plant, and you can smell chicken stuff through half the county. But
you know what that smells like?
Money.
It smells like money.
But if they're able to release the counter smell, and so then that smell doesn't leak out through the fat, or even in, say,
so what is the counter smell? Chicken crap.
I don't know. Lasagna, maybe. I'm just picking a random here, people. But like I said, you know, and say
we're
like,
flying blind here, folks. We haven't actually cracked the mathematical formula yet. But
like airplanes or stuff like that, where you're kind of in a confined space, and you know they're serving fish that night, and it kind of stinks up the whole plane. They can release the whatever the counter smell is to that, and keep everything
kitties?
Neutral. I mean, we could even spray it and come up with something for cigar shops, so people that don't like tobacco smoke can't. Smell the but then,
all right, you
then
know
that
what
would hurt us because we wouldn't be able to smell the
I mean
the sweet aroma.
Here's my philosophy though: if you don't like smoky environments, don't step foot in a cigar shop. Simple as that. Like, figure out another place to go on a date. Like, hey, I'm going to the cigar shop. I'll meet you an hour and a half at said destination.
I don't know, man. Have you ever cooked like collard greens or stuff? That stuff smells horrible. I mean, if you had like little anti. Some things do not, they may taste good, but they don't smell good while you're cooking them. or like places where it, like, say, a fish processing plant. That's just not a smell you want to be around all day. You could, like, squirt a little
but,
of that.
But, you know, then again, I mean, we hang out in a lot of cigar shops. I mean, I'm sure everybody at some point can relate to a pungent odor. Eventually, don't you become immune to it? Like,
well, yeah, most
I mean,
people that stay in that environment all the time, that your nose kind of becomes
desensitized.
Yeah, your brain like kind of like smokers don't smell smoke half the time because their brain has blocked that smell out because it's normal. But like I said, people that live near the chicken plant, like, they don't smell the chicken plant. It's when the rest of us go to that.
I think they're lying.
Oh, dude, when I went to North Forsyth High School for a little while. The people up there did not smell the chicken plant that was nearby, but me going there for one class a day could smell it.
I don't know. I still think the one of the worst in the area is just north of Cumming, the freaking dog food factory.
Yeah.
Like that place.
That's what I'm talking about, the rendering plant. The whole north end of the county smells, and people that live on the north end of the county don't notice it anymore. They've completely gone blind.
Yeah, there's a reason they live on the north end of the county.
But yeah, like I said, I mean, it would be interesting like this instead of just deodorizing stuff. You can completely eliminate unpleasant odors.
I mean, I don't know, but do smells, your smell receptacles, whatever the scientific name for that is, do they evolve and change like taste buds, though? I mean, could you potentially think that, oh, in this stage of my life, this is pungent, but later on, you know, would you potentially be missing out on something?
Well, the thing is, this doesn't affect how you smell the stuff anymore. It just combines that chemical odor with a opposing chemical odor that cancels each other out. So it really has nothing to do with your
So this your is smell. More like almost like a smelling salt compound, not like a surgery or something.
No,
basically
it's combining two smells that will cancel each other out is how it works. So it's not affecting you in any way. It's affecting the chemical makeup of the actual smell that's in the, you know, environment.
I see. So this is the purpose of the science segment. See, I'm starting to get educated now.
Learn some shit. Well, our next science article there, tripping.
Yeah, now something you know all about.
Dude, I have never tripped. But, you know, I'm not going to the Grateful Dead concerts, man. But scientists at the Imperial College of London have wondered, what does that look like on your brain? So now they've actually, you know, run people through an MRI that can, you know, show you your brain functions. And then gave them mushrooms.
Oh, crap, I'm tripping. I'm in my casket. Now I'm going to freak out.
To see how, you know,
this is what it looks like when I'm freaking out, because I'm in a casket.
Yeah, it's basically gave people doses of psychoblin or whatever the active ingredient is in magic mushrooms to add, you know, and also scan normal brains to see how they function in the same, you know, people they gave placebos to see how their brains functioned in the same, you know, experience. But so now they've really started studying how your brain actually interprets. Hallucinating.
Dude, just speaking of it, I think I'm tripping balls.
And my favorite part of this is the doctor that's performing these experiments is named Paul Expert.
The microphone just melted. Is that normal?
Yeah. I mean, he's an expert. That just adds credibility to his cause right there. And like, so people describe it, and according to the study, as, you know, hearing smells and seeing, you know,
yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of documentaries and stuff like that, that, you know, a lot of people that have experienced, you know, the whole hallucinogenic effects of magic mushrooms say, you know, most of the time, if they don't go batshit crazy, they come out with some kind of new appreciation. Like, you know, it's so much more of a complex world around them and stuff. And I don't know if it, you know, just sounds good on paper or, you know, if they truly feel some different euphoric sense of the world around them, but
yeah, they describe in the study as effects of new insights and realizations, synesthesia, and nonlinear thinking. But now they're saying what's causing this is from this research is they're finding that basically your brain operates as a series of networks. Like, you know, like I said, your hearing kind of comes from one part of your brain, your sight comes from another.
Yeah, I mean, you have different sensory
individual
areas,
isolated networks. They don't really communicate with each other. And these people that are on mushrooms, there's different brain connections are forming. Like I said,
so does it almost like rewire the brain then, in a sense?
Pretty much. I mean, instead of like, you know, say this one particular region is what you're using when you're hearing. Now you're using that region and three other regions. It's expanding the network and connecting in different parts that don't.
Dude, it's almost like tapping into the matrix.
Yeah. So yeah, basically it's just kind of mixing things up. So you're now using more parts of your brain for this one experience than you would, you know, normally.
Very, very interesting. So yeah. I guess on the next episode, we're going to go get some magic mushrooms and, you know, see how we fare doing a trip cast.
We're not having bad trips here in the Nerd Cave.
You said they had to be bad, man. Why you just got to assume negative? See, that's why you could use some mushrooms.
We do not support illegal activities here in the Nerd Cave.
Well, hell. All right, well, that sums that up, folks.
Yeah, well, I'm not performing any of these experiments myself. I'll let the Imperial College of London do all the experimenting with tripping that you want.
Well, what's next?
Well, we got some, you ever wonder what a dead body in the ocean looks like?
A floating corpse?
Well, scientists are now studying how bodies decompose underwater.
Sweet.
For forensic
you know what they're preparing for. See how freaking underwater zombies, if the water decays them any faster or anything.
Well, you know, forensic entomologists, that's one thing they study is how bodies decompose for you know, like there's a big lab in Kentucky called the Body Farm where they just basically, people who donate their bodies to science, they put them out.
I wonder if that's what that organ donor sticker means.
But they take bodies and put them out into like different simulated environments out in the woods and kind of track how they decompose. And it helps, you know, future crime labs, you know, determine how long a body's been, you know, been
kind of basically, you know, if it's been there, you know, overnight or if it's been there for 3 weeks. Yeah,
trying to pinpoint like, you know, time of death, whether or not other chemicals were present at the time of death. It has a lot of, you know, criminology implications. Well, there's not a whole lot of studies about what happens in like an aquatic environment. So now,
dude, just look at freaking Jason Voorhees. That's all you need to know.
Been rotting at the bottom of Camp Crystal Lake. Gail Anderson, a forensic entomologist, is heading at Simon Fraser University in Canada. So we know stuff's bad already. It's in Canada. Yeah, don't want to go full walrus.
God. I don't know. I can't even touch that one. I'm just going to leave it alone.
So with this this experiment, they're not using humans. They're using pigs, which is basically their bodies kind of work the same way as ours.
People are like pigs.
Yeah, you know, pigs.
I
are
like
the
bacon. Pigs are bacon.
Yeah.
Therefore, people are bacon.
Yeah, pigs are our closest, you know, biological relative. I mean, our bodies kind of work the same ways and decompose in the same ways. Well, there's a
they consume bacon in the same ways.
Yeah. There's an underwater lab in Canada called Victoria Experimental Network Under the Sea, or Venus. And basically,
I knew NASA was lying to me.
Basically, it's a lab that people can do underwater experiments and track data.
So I wonder what the Uranus lab looks like.
Dude, not even. But they can check their stuff remotely via the internet. So basically, you don't have to have a scientist on scene. They can set up experiments there and monitor them on their computers, which means...
So you know there's a Uranus somewhere because nobody wants to go there.
Dude. No. Shut up. But, they're sinking pigs into the ocean, and they have basically webcams set up where they can monitor how these pigs decompose underwater. And if you go to their website, which, like I said, there's a link in this article to their website, you can actually watch the webcam
footage. So
where
is the EPA at in all of this saying that, hey, decomposing pig bodies in the ocean, nah, that's probably some type of pollutant or something that's
negatively impacting our... it has scientific...
what happens when the fish become addicted to bacon instead of other fish, and then the next thing you know, we've screwed up the entire ecosystem of the ocean?
That's
are people
get,
not
like,
thinking
you know,
about these things? I mean, I'm just throwing it out there.
That's when we get Jaws. You know, I don't think Jaws can get on the land, but like crabs invade the Midwest and try to hunt down pigs so they can feed their insatiable bacon urges.
I mean, I'd just substitute for King Kong or something.
Yeah, watching these videos of the experimenter is kind of wild, seeing how, like I said, the undersea life just descends on on the pigs. It's definitely.
And all this time,
don't
I thought
Venus
was in outer space.
It's somewhere in Canada, Victoria, Canada, to be exact.
I knew Victoria once, just once. So yeah, I mean, rather interesting stuff there, Joe. Now I've learned that space is not what I thought it was. That Venus is underwater, and I still can't talk about Uranus without getting some smart-ass comment.
Never talk about my anus.
And with that...
All right, I think that about wraps it up for some science. We'll be back here in a few minutes with some nerd news.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in nerd news.
And welcome, folks, to the nerd news segment.
Yeah.
Today, we're going to be talking things nerd music. A little bit of a different direction for us here.
Yeah, we're going to see MC Chris later this week, so we figured it's a good time to talk about our favorite, you know, nerdy bands and such.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how that show's going to turn out. Looks like MC Lars is opening for him, so up until, you know, I saw him on the venue list, I wasn't too familiar with his music and everything, but I did some research, and, dude, I actually like it. It's really good.
And our guest from our opening segments back for some musical opinions, What's you got any like favorite nerd bands you want to throw out there?
Yeah, sure. I like Weezer quite a bit. Nerf Herder, Rush, Led Zeppelin's my favorite band. They're one of the nerdiest bands of all time. Just from the Lord of the Rings at all, but
yeah, we were just listening to some Nerf Herder earlier because I don't think I'd heard about it until you mentioned it. We had to go. I think was it Mr. Spock and what was the other song we were listening to?
Yeah, I mean there were a couple. Unfortunately, I can't recall now. I don't know. I've already started my day off early. We continued on with the Beer 30 segment.
I'm on my third monster for the day, dude. So I'm good to go for a while.
I'm waiting on you to start turning into halfway a monster.
Halfway through the next segment, I'm just going to like hit the wall and crash, but now I'm good to go.
I mean, we've touched on MC Chris.
We've
others that come to mind. I mean,
but like I said, we've used MC Chris stuff from the on other
our very first
stuff.
Episode.
Yeah, and like I said, he's been around for a while, and a lot of the other nerdy bands that I've discovered through the years have been people who have opened for MC Chris on tour. Like I said, I'd never heard MC Lars until he was scheduled. We listened to some of his stuff, too.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that how we stumbled upon Tribe One as well?
Yeah, we used the Marvel A to Z for our MCU episode. And that's, like I said, I saw him at MC Chris last time he was in town. And he's a local Atlanta guy, too. So if you all are in the area, get a chance to check him out. He does an awesome nerdcore rap show.
All right, so now I'm going to take it a completely different direction.
All right.
You know, you touched on Rush and Led Zeppelin and stuff, so let's go that direction because it pulls at my heart being a guitar player. Power Glove, man.
Oh, yeah, Power Glove. Metal, video game, and cartoon music.
No, I love it, man. I mean, it's everything. There's not too many, unfortunately, nerdcore songs that I can sit down and strum along to on guitar, but, you know, Power Glove, man, I get to bust out some of the freaking tapping techniques and everything else on guitar. So, I mean, it's just a blast opportunity to dial the knobs up to 11 and just raise unholy hell.
Yeah, they're, was it the Batman? They do cover the Batman theme. That's one of my favorite ones in the Inspector Gadget. For that, the Inspector metal version of the Inspector Gadget theme is just badass.
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of touching on the lines of metal cover bands. I mean, some of the stuff comes to mind, like Tin Mask Men. You know, you get these, you know, freaking guys up there doing metal versions of Christina Aguilera and stuff like that. You know, it's just absolutely hilarious. The two genres that should never meet.
Oh yeah, we have fallen down some serious YouTube holes where we just like Google. Like nerd, like, you know, Doctor Who metal or
yeah,
Star
I mean, we've
Wars
been
dubstep.
To the friggin' deepest, darkest depths of the rabbit hole. As if our first segment didn't already tell you that.
Well, let me pose this question since you two are more mainstream, you know, musical knowledge than I have. What's a normal band that is not a nerdcore band that has a good nerdy song? Is there any that y'all come to mind?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. First one that comes to mind for me is mainstream band Cake does a great version of Menomina from the old Muppet
All right,
Show.
Yes. I'm just going to throw it out there. I absolutely despise the band, but, I, you know, do you guys remember when Limp Bizkit came out and they had the whole Mission Impossible theme going on?
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many freaking kids in middle school rushed out to buy guitars just so they could strum along to those eight notes.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember Green Jelly? Or Green Jelly?
The
Three Little Pigs.
Little Pig. Yeah.
Let me in. You know, I'm going to take it a little bit old school, a little bit different direction, too. The Meteors and their rockabilly cover of... Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an awesome song.
I forgot all about that.
Wow.
And, of course, Primus did the South Park theme.
Yep,
of course. And Primus is definitely a good...
That's what I was watching before I came here.
Like our head, no nose, one desire. I mean, some of the other ones that we touch... Richie Branson, you know,
is another one that comes to mind. He does a cool... well, he actually did a bunch of stuff for Adult Swim, too. He did, like, the Bring Back Toonami... theme song, and he does a cover of JC's 99 Problems, but it's called Cloud City, and it's sung from the point of Lando. Oh, I got 99 awesome. Problems, but a Sith ain't one.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, if I had a Sith, chances are it'd probably be a problem. I don't know. Maybe I could turn to the dark side and it'd be all right. I don't know.
Hey, if you can't beat them, join them. Yeah, they, according to their bumper stickers, they have cookies, so
Another one you was talking about, mentioned in Adult Swim, is Unknown Henson, who does the voice of the main character on Squidbillies. And he's got kind of a, he's like an outlaw rockabilly guy. He couldn't be insane. Elvis or Jimi Hendrix, so he pretty much spoofs Elvis and Jimi Hendrix. The thing of it is, though, is note for note, he's one of the better Hendrix cover guys out there. And he's dressed with the pompadour and, you know, fake sideburns and the cigarette hanging out. Looks like a methed out Elvis playing Little Wing. Got to check it out on YouTube. It's great.
Well, I mean, you take out the methed out aspect of it and replace the cigarette with a cigar, and I'd say, you know, we'd probably kick it with that dude on the podcast sometime.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like my kind of people.
I've wandered into a rockabilly club a time or two, and it's always a fun environment.
Moving right along here, another one that comes to mind. I mean, not all of their stuff is nerdy, but I like the way they play into pop culture and everything. And then they even take it old school, and you get some Edgar Allan Poe, Epic Rap Battles of History.
Oh my gosh!
Oh yeah, for a weird, goofy YouTube thing. That they've got some good rhymes.
Dude, the flows
they
are
tight. They are serious
and,
about it.
Yeah. I mean, the costumes of looking at all these guys on their YouTube videos, yes. too. I mean, they get so well into character, and I'm almost envious. I'm like...
I mean, all the Darth Vader versus Hitler ones, those are like a must-see. I'm like the... was it Chuck Norris versus Bruce Lee is a good one?
Bill Nye versus Sir Isaac Newton.
Yes.
I mean, that was
with
fantastic.
Weird Al as Sir Isaac Newton.
That was fantastic.
Speaking like, you know, of
he's the,
the godfather of nerd music.
King of nerd rock. Yeah, yeah. Undisputed.
That's one thing I like about these nerd bands is it's not so much a done for comedy. I mean, they are serious about the music they do. They just happen to be, you know, nerdy
topics.
Well,
I think that's the thing, you know, in starting the whole nerd podcast that we did is, I mean... You know, I can say we haven't reached millions of people yet, but, I mean, dude,
I
take everything
our
that we
numbers.
Do seriously. Yeah, there. I mean, you know, you're definitely making your rounds, being on the Wretched Cast earlier. So, you know, I mean, taking it old school and retro.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun day. So what's some other?
Armamonoguchi.
Oh, Onomonoguchi, yeah. If you like 8-bit old school Nintendo sounding music, they do the theme for Nerdist, his podcast, and yeah, they've got some interesting music.
Yeah, anybody that's a fan of 8-bit, I mean, you know, any music lovers out there, MIDI will be your best friend in this topic.
Just hit YouTube and put, you know, 8-bit rock, 8-bit whatever, and you'll find some interesting.
There's a lot of it out there.
Oh yeah, and Doctor Who, the band
Doctor
Chameleon
Circuit.
No, yeah, Chameleon Circuit. They're an English band that all they do is Doctor Who. Songs about Doctor Who. They've got 3 albums about Doctor Who.
That's awesome.
I mean, they've got some good songs. It was I'm blanking on. There's like I'm blanking on the actual titles of some of the songs. But yeah, check them out.
The vocal chords are already starting to give way.
It's that third
so
monster
today.
Band. My brain's working faster
than
my mouth can go.
I'm surprised you're even able to stay stationary in front of the mic at this point. I mean, I'm waiting any moment now.
I'm just going
to
start vibrating in my head.
Running around the room.
It'll look like scanners. It's going to be bad.
Maybe you'll levitate. You know.
Yeah. Another one that comes from Dr. Awkward.
Dr. Awkward. I saw him last time he was in town, and it was cool. He does a song a little bit different, which the video for that is hysterical. You should check it on YouTube because it looks like typical gangster rap video.
Which is just a little bit different.
But then it flips, and it's like all the things. Like you see a guy like, you know, rolling up, you think there's about to be a drug deal, but when he gets to it, they're like, he's selling them like an old school NES game. And there's like all these guys like hanging out in this, you know, on the corner. And it turns out they're waiting in line at GameStop for the new game release.
Yeah, I've seen that one. You know, you got
just,
the guy
looks
on the
stereotypically
trench coat.
Yeah.
Opens it up and it's all NES games and stuff. Like,
you see them. You think they're playing like craps or, you know, whatever, like street gambling game, and they're playing like Chutes and Ladders and Magic or. Yeah, everything looks like from the far looks like a stereotypical rap video, and then he just flips it and it's all like them doing just some nerdy shit,
which is just awesome. So I'm going to take a little bit different direction. I mean, you touched on it just a little bit. You know, take it old school. I mean, you get Key and Peele doing the freaking steampunk bits and everything.
They've appeared on Epic Rap Battles, too, a couple episodes. The Martin Luther King versus Gandhi is pretty good. Cool. Yeah, and what was the other one they did?
Things on the surface Rami. May not be what they appear.
But they
Key and Peele are great.
They had one. It was Muhammad Ali versus Michael Jordan. That one was pretty good, too.
All right. So we're going to switch it a little bit different direction again. So these are just some, you know, steampunky or just bands that, you know, I've going down the rabbit holes on YouTube have stumbled upon. You know, we played a couple times L Storm and referenced them.
Yeah, I mean, they're just a band of drunken pirates. All their songs are about pirates and rum, pretty much.
It's all
much.
About plundering the booty.
Yeah. You can never go wrong with plundering the booty.
How about Extraordinary Contraptions on the steampunk front?
Yeah, they've played some cool ones. They had that they've got a steampunk cover of, instead of I'm on a boat, it's I'm on a blimp.
Yes.
Yeah. First time I saw that was on Dragon Con TV.
Yeah, and... with Steampunk Fett. Yeah, that's a great video.
Just tying a little Jules. It's all blimps and shit.
Have you seen the Keaton Pill steampunk clip yet?
No.
We'll show you that after we're done. That's, yeah. That's hysterical.
That's something everybody should go in YouTube right now. Pause the podcast. Key and Pill steampunk.
Yeah, when anyone's like, "What's steampunk?" Just play in that video. Yeah. It'll explain everything.
Just be careful. Don't put that pipe up to your eye and pretend it's a telescope.
And see what else we got. Estonian Crypt, Abney Park.
Abney Park, yes. Yep.
Those guys are great.
Yeah, I've got to see them live. I've heard their music, but every time they've played at like a con or something, I've missed it.
Yeah, I've seen them at Dragon Con twice. They put a really good show on. They're not scared of encores. They'll come out and do a full encore set, you know, like 8 songs. And
nice.
It's pretty good. They're really good. They're a real good, you know, hall musician where if you're just running around through the concourse of the hall, they're out there playing. It's really good. And they'll, you know, interact with the crowd really well. They're a really
good
act.
I think that's the only
time
I've actually seen them play is when they've just been at their table or whatever jamming, but I've not gone to their actual show.
It's a lot of energy. A lot of energy.
Yeah, steampunks like to party, I've found out. Yeah, I've gotten more into
that. I don't
think
there's been any form of steampunk con I haven't been to that just turned into pure drunken debauchery.
Yeah, you're not steampunk unless you're like, you know, sipping.
Something about all those steampunk costumes, you can really build up some liquor tolerance. They don't seem to be as drunk and slovenly as some of the other.
I learned
2 days
when,
in.
You got to
be able to keep your game up to hang out.
I mean, they can drink, man. Some hollow legs.
Well, I mean, I'll say it. Yeah. AcroCon, you know, doing the champagne sabering and everything, dude. I think that's probably one of the drunkest drunken appearances I've made in a very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whiskey. Champagne has nothing on whiskey. That stuff sneaks up on you.
I don't think it snuck up on me, man. I think from the moment we said go, 2 glasses in, I was like, I don't know what an alcohol or beer tolerance, you know, level I have.
Could be us. We hadn't like 8 that day yet, so.
Nor had a cigar.
Yeah,
so,
we did have a cigar after that, though, so it kind of evened us out a little bit.
Yeah, a new band that I stumbled upon, The Melting Clock, you know, kind of interesting. Yeah, I mean, you know, once again, just stumbled upon, and, I mean, one of the gems hidden in YouTube. So, you know, I encourage you folks that are, you know, interested in branching out your diversity and building up your music libraries and things, you know, go out, support some of these artists. And, I mean, that's one thing that I'll say about nerdcore, steampunk, all the... People pour their heart and blood into this stuff. And, I mean, it really shows in their music where on the surface, it may just seem like a comedy bit or anything. But, you know, behind the scenes, you know, there's a lot of these people,
it's not just a joke thing. I mean, they take their comedy very, very seriously. You know, they let their fandom show through their music. I mean, what's the girl we were listening to the other night, the violinist?
Lindsay Sterling.
Yes. I mean, she's got some amazing songs, too.
Yeah, she's great.
Dude, yeah, I mean, people like that just make me not want to pick up an instrument anymore.
Yeah,
I mean, I just look and I say,
it's like, I'm out.
I'm sorry, folks. I'm not going to give you that feeling that she just did, so there's no way I can compete.
Yeah, because her latest video was, like, very steampunk, too, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, she's done a lot of good collaboration, like, with Pentatonix and groups like that. Just, she knocks it out of the park every time. I actually... really like all the Assassin's Creed and Zelda soundtrack stuff she's done.
Yes.
It's just sit and listen to that while I'm riding in my truck to work. So yeah.
That's what we found her like steampunk video the other day and just fell down another YouTube hole where I end up listening to like 5 or 6 of her songs in a row. We get lost sometimes when we search.
It's just like, you know, watching the video of the guy, you know, you see one guy playing the NES, the other guy's on the violin, and as you see Mario jumping and, you know, smashing the blocks, the dude's replicating the music and all the sound effects, you know, right on par. And I'm just like, dude, that just blows my mind.
Yeah, so I was at a concert one time, and I can't remember the name of the band, but between sets, the bass player just got bored and started playing the dungeon theme on the bass for Mario. Like, I was like, oh, that is awesome.
Here you go, folks. And I mean, you know, I'll take it a little bit further. Stephen Lynch and his rendition of D&D. Love that song. I mean, dude, that speaks to my freaking high school years and everything. I mean, sitting in basements with Funyuns and Mountain Dew and everything. So, I think
that about wraps us up. Any final thoughts on musics or the Josh Whedon collection?
Get out there and
collection?
Explore and support these people busting their balls to bring you good music.
Sir?
A lot of good Celtic music out there, too, if you're into some more non-traditional. Mark Gunn, Emerald Rose, Brobdingnagian and Bards, those are always fun bands to listen to.
I definitely awesome. Dig me some Celtic music.
All right, well, I guess that wraps us up this week. Don't forget to check us out on iTunes and Stitcher. Hit our website, CigarNerdPodcast.com. Send us an email at CigarNerdPodcast@gmail.com. Tweet us at CigarNerdPod. And, as always, we aim to misbehave. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.